Thank you. I'm Chuck C., and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chuck.
Hi. Before I get going, I want to do something that Clancy won't like. I want my wife of 53 years and Clancy's wife off and on for about half that time to stand up. Stand up. Now I want to share a few personal thoughts with you. When I was shaving tonight, getting ready to come down here, I was looking at the past. First, looking at Clancy's past, because it's more recent than mine. And I was remembering a few years before, 20 years ago, when I wouldn't have given you a plugged nickel for Clancy and all of his chances for the future and the past. He was the saddest sack that I have ever seen, I think. He didn't have his teeth. He was ugly as hell. He didn't have any money. Living in a back end of a wrecked car in the 6300 Club parking lot. And he was arrogant as hell. And there wasn't any way that he could make this program. No way at all. And I wouldn't have given a plug nickel for it. And then I looked at me, 33 years ago, and I wouldn't have given a plug penny for me. I was better looking than he was. But when that's said, it's all said. And there's no way that he could be having a 20th birthday tonight. And no way that I could be having a 33rd by the middle of January if I don't drink or pill or pot or acid. Between now and then. This lad had 140 babies here for dinner tonight. 140. Hell, I could take a shotgun and I couldn't get together 140. I've been here almost twice as long as he has. And I was looking at the mileage just casually. And in these last 32 years, I have driven my car over 1,000,000 miles in AA. Just AA. And the miles that I've flown, I have no idea. No idea. And so that's something. And I suspect that Clancy might top that by the time he's 33. Really? I suspect between the two of us, We've talked with maybe 2.5 million people, really. Maybe more than that. I don't know. Now, isn't that something? For a couple of guys that came out from under a rock, like he did and I did, into a life like this, there's only one thing I can say to you. I'm so grateful I can't see. I'm so grateful I can't see. I take credit for the first 43 years of my life. Because during that time, I was the master of ceremonies and the star of the show. And at ripe old age of 43, I was a failure as a husband, a father, a businessman, a man, and a drunk. And that's all the departments I had. If I'd had any more departments, I'd have failed in them too. But that was all. Now, maybe you don't think that you can be a failure as a drunk. But I was. Because I got to the point where I couldn't buy liquor with money. And I think when that happens, you're a failure as a drunk. And I'll just tell you a little about that. My favorite supplier was a guy by the name of Vic. And he had a liquor store just west of Beverly Drive. I lived in Beverly Hills through all my bad drinking and the first 11 years of my sobriety. And Vic was just west of Beverly Drive on Pico. And during the years, I had paid off his mortgage, put his kids through school, giving him a pretty good bank account, besides helping him open up every morning. And the last time I was there to help him open up, he finally got there. You know, the last 20 minutes before he got there, of a morning to open that store, was longer than my whole 32 years and 6 months in Alcoholics Anonymous. God, it was a long time. And he finally got there that morning, and I helped him get in and get the door open. Walked in right behind him, and he walked around behind the counter, and instead of reaching for my bottle, he crossed his arms like that, and he looked at me and he said, "Chuck, I have witnessed your demise as long as I'm going to. I'll never sell you another bottle of whiskey as long as you live, and I'm telling you now to get the hell out of my store and stay out, because I'm not going to watch you die." I left there thinking he was the most ungrateful son of a bitch I'd ever seen. After all I'd done for him, he won't sell me liquor and I've got the money in my hand. But that was one of the things that helped me get here. It was pretty tough to take because I'd known him for years, you know. So I take credit for the first 43 years of my life. I take absolutely no credit for the last 32 years and a half. No credit at all. The first weekend of this year, I talked in Torrance. There's a lady over there that has a birthday that I've been talking at for years, and I was there. And the first, they had a speaker before me. And he was a Scotchman, and he had a patch over his eye. And he got up, and he made an awfully good talk, short talk. But during this talk, he said not less than a half dozen times, I'm sober today by choice. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous by choice. Half a dozen times he said that. And when I got up, I said, I'm sure glad that Scotty is a member of this society by choice. Because I'm not. As long as I had the power of choice, my choice was never to come here. And I never came. Until I ran out of everything, including the power of choice. So I can take absolutely no credit for anything that's happened in the last 32 years and a half. And as I told you, my gratitude grows with the days. And my gratitude starts with people like you. Drunks who are not drunk. Because you were the people that took me in and rocked me to sleep 32 years ago. So my gratitude starts with you. Then to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that's the way it came to me. And then to my very own God. Because that's the way it happened. And to you and to the program and to my very own God, I'm so grateful I can't see. Because my life for 32 years now, or for such time as I can remember of the 32 years, because I wasn't well when I came. My life has been fabulous. I could empty the Colosseum in 15 minutes by just starting to talk about what's happened to me in 32 years. And they'd say there's no use to listen to this idiot, you know. And they'd get up and go home. But that's the way it has been. And I want to tell you how it happened. Many of you have heard this, but my last drunk to date started the Friday before Christmas, 1945. My boss man called me in, and I knew it was curtains because I had it coming, but he didn't can me. He started talking, which was a good sign. And he said to me, Charlie, I was Charlie in business. He says, you've had a lot of trouble this year. He was a non-alcoholic. And he says, I think that I know what causes it. I think it's because of the pressures you're under. Now, says he, I'm going to take a little of the pressure off of you. And maybe next year you won't have so much pressure and you won't have so much trouble. And instead of shooting me as he had every right to do, he gave me $3,000 for a Christmas present. The Friday before Christmas, 1945, to take the pressure off of me. Now, if you don't think he took the pressure off of me, you're nuts. There's one thing that's worse for an alcoholic than bad fortune, and that's good fortune. So I got drunk on the way home. Which is not like it should have been. Because I was a periodic for the last 10 years. And periodics don't get drunk on the way home. Periodics never taper off. They taper on. And it usually took me from 30 to 60 days to get off my feet after a dry spell from the time I started nibbling until I got down. I always made it, but it wasn't that quickly. But my last one, I remember nothing from the time I left the office on the Friday before Christmas till after the middle of January, 1946. And I came to sometime after the middle of January 1946 with the clearest head I've ever known in my life, which is another thing that's impossible, because I never ate when I drank. And I had nothing in my skin but whiskey. And yet I came to with the clearest head I've ever known. And I saw me for the first time in my life with nothing between me and me. Sometime between the Friday before Christmas and the middle of January, everything between me and me had burned out. All the excuses were gone, including Mrs. C's mother. Now there was a king-size reason for getting drunk. That old biddy had only one daughter, and I was married to her, and she was living with us, and she had a grandstand seat watching me crucify her only daughter, and she didn't like me very good, and I didn't like her that good, because if she hadn't been living with us, I wouldn't have had to crucify her daughter, so it was all her fault. We had a mutual hating society that was a beautiful thing to behold, I'll tell you. She lasted 5 years at least, after all the rest of my excuses had gone. But this morning she was even gone, and there were no excuses left. And I saw me as I was. Now, lest I forget to do this, I'll tell you what happened to her. She lived with us 5 years after I sobered up. And it is absolutely astounding what this program did for her. In the last year that she lived, if she'd have come in and found me slapping that wife of mine all over the house, she would have looked at her and she'd say, "Why, Elsa, what have you done?" Because by then I couldn't do any wrong at all. And the wonder of wonders is that she wouldn't believe that anybody or anything had helped me at all. Not even God. She knew that I had done it. Now mind you, she hated me worse than poison. And by this time, she was certain that I had done all of this by myself. And she'd come up and put her arms around me and she'd say, "Oh, son, I always knew you had it in you." I'd start blushing at my shoe tops and right out the top of my head. But she wouldn't even believe that God helped me, you know. I'd done it by myself. So, the excuses were all gone, including her. And I knew that I'd lost the battle of life. Now that's the first time in my life, in 43 years, that I'd ever admitted defeat one time. Now don't think that I won all my battles. I didn't. I got the hell kicked out of me on many occasions. But it was by accident. He hit me first. I'd get him next time. And sometimes I did, and sometimes I got God again, too. But nobody had ever made me admit defeat. But that morning I knew I'd lost a battle of life. I didn't know why, because I knew nothing of alcoholism. The biggest majority of you people in this room tonight can't remember when there wasn't an Alcoholics Anonymous. But I ran out of time before Alcoholics Anonymous was born. Alcoholics Anonymous was 43 years old, the 10th day of last June. And I had already run out of time before it was born. I tried for another 10 years to prove I hadn't. But at the end of that 10 years, I'd proven that I had. So, I knew nothing of alcoholism, but I knew it lost the battle of life. And I accepted it. I knew why Mrs. C. was divorcing me after 20 years. I might say to you, without cause. I'd given her 20 of the best years of my life. And she's divorcing me. And I knew why. And I knew she should have done it 10 years before. And I knew why our children wouldn't come home when I was around. And I knew why that same boss man that had given me the 3 had sent word to the house that if I ever stepped foot in the plant again, he was going to throw me through the window. And the window, which he had picked out, don't open. I accepted the fact that morning that everything dear to me in life was gone and should be gone. And that I was not entitled to have it back. Now I'm going to say that again because this is what my life has been built on for the last 32 years. I totally and completely accepted the fact that morning that everything dear to me in life was gone and should be gone. And that I was not entitled to have it back. I also accepted death. Because on the next to the last trip out, I'd come as close to dying as you can. And this was worse. I'd gone to the kitchen in my withdrawal period to get a glass of buttermilk. Mrs. C and Richard were sitting in the living room. They heard me let out a beller and heard me hit the floor. And they came running out thinking that they would find me in an alcoholic convulsion, which was my wont. But I'd already used up all my convulsions. I wasn't convulsing at all. I was lying there on the kitchen floor as peaceful as anybody you ever saw. I wasn't doing nothing. They tell me I was a peculiar color. I was blue. And they couldn't wake me up, so they got all exercised and called the oxygen squad at the Beverly Hills Receiving Hospital. Told them to send down a squad and see what they could do with me. And as serious as this is, it's one of the funniest things that I can think of. Because that woman and those kids had been praying for me to die for at least 5 years. And they came to the kitchen and found me dead and called the oxygen squad. Isn't that something? Now, to show you, that isn't a figment of my imagination. And you know, she's sitting right over there. She belongs to another society. I think they call it Ala Nani Nani and a Hot Cha Cha. And she does a lot of talking on her own. As a matter of fact, she goes all over the country yakking and leaves me home to cook my own breakfast. That's right. That's right. Sure, thank you. And she'll get up here talking to this many people if she can find them. And you know what she tells us? She said, I found myself on many occasions trying to figure out how to do away with this son of a bitch and not get caught. Now, she was talking about killing me, which I don't think is very nice. And when she found me dead, she called the oxygen squad. And I have reason to believe they brought me 2. I remember what happened after I came to. There was a young doctor with him. And he told me, says he to me, he says, to all intents and purposes, you were dead. We've had a hell of a time bringing you to. It's our opinion that nobody will ever bring you to again under these circumstances. And then he gave me the finest piece of counsel I'll ever hear in my life, regardless of how long I live. He looked me right in the eye and he said, if I were you, I wouldn't do that anymore. But I did it again. And the last time was worse than the next of the last time. So I knew I was going to die, and it was all right. But I didn't want to die with a record. I didn't want to die with a record. And I remembered, in the bottom of this snake pit, that Mrs. C. had found and read Jack Alexander's article in the Saturday Evening Post 4.5 years before this. She had thought it might be of some value to me, and had put it open at the right page on the left arm of the chair I sit in right now. And when I came in, I read it. And I remembered it on this morning. I only remembered two things about it, because I was drunk when I read it. But I remembered that drunks help drunks and didn't drink. And they called it Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to myself, if I ever live to get out of this bed, I will find AA. And instantly the curtain dropped. My sanity was gone. And I was sickened to death, drunk and insane. And I had a lot of dying to do. But from the second of commitment until right now, I have never had a sedating or tranquilizing pill or a drink of alcoholic beverage of any kind. Such is the great significance of this thing called surrender. Surrender. Surrender is victory for the alcoholic. And the greatest single event that's ever happened in my entire life was when the bottle surrendered me. Sometime between the Friday before Christmas and the end of January, 1946. And I got to this program, surrendered. I did not know it. Now, just for the fun of it, I'll tell you a few things that have happened since. Because these monkeys used all my time. Why do they have 6 or 8 speakers before I get up here? You notice what they did. Nobody in this country would have talked against me tonight. So they got one from Memphis, Tennessee, and one from Oklahoma. Imported them just to cut down my time. I didn't know where to find you folks. My keen alcoholic mind told me that you would not be in the phone book. You were anonymous, weren't you? They don't anonymous in the phone book. So knowing you wouldn't be there, I never looked. Which is the story of my life. I knew so damn much that wasn't true, I couldn't learn anything that was. So I had to call people and ask them if they knew anybody that knew anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. And it took a little while to find you. So I went to the office before I'd ever been into an AA meeting. The boss saw my old car in the parking lot, knew I was on the premises, and knew I wasn't going to stay. And he came hunting for me, and he busted into my office like a bull in a china closet. And I couldn't have defended myself with a shotgun because I wasn't well. I didn't have the shakes. I had the leaps. And all I could do was sit there at the desk and say, Victor, leave me alone. I don't work for you anymore. I'm down here to clean up this desk. I'm here to do the things you paid me for last year that it didn't do. And as soon as I get even with you, you'll get the hell out of here on my own power. And you'll never owe me a penny as long as you live, and you don't have to throw me out. But for God's sake, leave me alone. I have to get even with you. And he stopped his tracks. And he said, "What the hell's happened to you, Charlie?" And I said, "Don't know." And I didn't. But he knew something had happened. And he didn't throw me through the window. I talked to one other person prior to that time, and that was Miss C. I told you she was divorcing me, so what I'm about to tell you was no magnanimous move on my part. It was something I had to say to her. I called her in and I says, "Honey, it's no longer of any consequence to me whether or not I live under this roof. It is of absolutely no importance to me at all. I'll never ask a thing of you as long as the two of us live, but one. If I ever have anything that will add to your life, let me give it to you." And we closed the book, and it's never been reopened. Now, if she were talking tonight, she would say that she knew the first time that I talked with her that something had happened. But I didn't. 2.5 years or 3 years or something after that, I might be talking to the man at lunch about business. And he stopped me in the middle of a sentence. And he said, "Charlie, what the hell's happened to you? I've been knowing you for 25 years and I don't know you. What's happened?" And I'd say, "I don't know," because I didn't. I didn't know anything had happened. But I started the day that I met you people in my first meeting, and I went there by myself alone. I haven't time to tell you why that came about, but it did. And I liked what I felt in the room. I liked what I saw. I saw your eyes. And there was something. And I came back every night. For 6 months, I was in a meeting every night. Knowing that I couldn't have this thing because I didn't have enough physically or mentally to get it. And I knew it. But after 6 months of a meeting every night, I had my first great discovery. And that was that I hadn't had a drink or pill for 6 months. Now that was a tremendous discovery for me. Because there it was. And I was so pleased about that that I got lost in trying to give this thing back to the drunk who still suffered. And I was very busy with that. And another 6 months went by, or thereabouts. And I discovered I had a family. And that was a great discovery. And I'll just tell you one little thing about that. I had me a girl in those first months from Beverly Hills. She was about 20, 25 years my senior. And she had a little bitty thing. She walked like she was walking on eggs. She was from up in the big numbers. And she had big numbers. She was very wealthy. I lived between Wilshire and Olympic, down on the flatlands where the poor people lived. But she lived up yonder. And she was quite a gal. She dressed to the teeth for every A meeting that I ever took her to, which was many. And she always wore a hat. You never saw that in AA, most of you. But she always wore a hat. Very, very proper. And sometime between the first 6 months and first year, she called my house thinking to get me. And she got Mrs. C on the phone. And she says, "Who the hell are you?" Miss C says, well, I'm Chuck's wife.
Didn't know he had a wife.
And Miss C says, well, he doesn't either. And I didn't. But I discovered I had a wife and kids. And they were living like kittens. And that wasn't bad. And another year, no, maybe 6 months, went by. And I discovered I was still trying to clean up my desk. And business was good. Business was good. And now another year has gone by. And I discovered that my state of being, my own life, was better than anything I'd ever dreamed of. And, of course, that was quite a discovery. And now either 5 or 6 years have gone by, and I can't place this. But it was either 5 or 6 years. And I discovered I was never alone anymore. I, who had walked alone all my life, and I discovered I was never alone anymore. I had a God of my very own. And wherever I am, He is. Now, that's the great discovery. That's the great discovery. We make this discovery and the search is over. And life begins. Now, my opinion of this program of ours is that it's nothing in the world but uncovering, discovering, and discarding. Uncovering, discovering, and discarding. And all of it, as far as I am able to perceive, is an inside job. Every bit of it is an inside job. It is my opinion that there's no one in this room tonight that needs anything added to their lives. All they need is to uncover and discover what's already there. Because having lived with people like you for over 32 years, I am convinced from the top of my longest hair to my toenails that the first two words of the Lord's Prayer mean what they say. Our Father, God. Now, if that's true, you can let your imagination go absolutely crazy. And you can't get close to the truth of being itself. You can't even get close to it. Our Father, God. I, His kid. Now, if I'm His kid, you are. If one of us are His child, all of us are. If one of us ain't, none of us are. And I am, so you is. And it's not something added. It's something uncovered and discovered. And this is one of the reasons that I am not in sympathy with so much of what y'all are doing in the program right now. Which is self-thinking. Self-thinking. I don't know how many pens those of you who are in this room tonight have worn out in the last 6 months running home and writing. It's all I hear about you monkeys. You get some feeling somewhere or other and you run home and write. Write, 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 write. I don't think it's... Well, according to me, now, and that's all I know, because I never did it. According to me, that ain't it. Because self-thinking is insanity. Self-thinking is insanity. Our problem is I want or don't want, I don't like, I yi yi yi. That's self-thinking. That's what got us here. My next project That's Polish for project. We got a Polish Pope now, you know. I'm going to use Polish as best I can from now on. But anyway, my next project is to go around and collect all the think signs in all the meeting halls and clubhouses in the United States and having a great bonfire. You know, for an alcoholic, thinking is disaster. Particularly if you drink and think, you're done. You either want to think or drink, but God mixes them up. Thinking is what got us here, so quit thinking and start doing. I was sure for 43 years of my life that as soon as I knew enough, everything was going to be all right. And when I knew everything there was to know, there wasn't anything that I didn't know. I couldn't even get out of bed and come and tell you what I knew. And for a philosopher, my ability, that is bad. So now I'm pretty well convinced that you can live yourself into right thinking, but you cannot think yourself into right living. So, if we take the first 9 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, honestly, for sobriety only, not for related disorders, I think that most of us are working on related disorders now, writing about this and stuff like that. I had a few. The lady over there was divorcing me. Our kids wouldn't spit on me. The boss was going to throw me through the window. I had no home, no job, no health, no sanity, and no money, which I believe to be pretty good related disorders. I don't think you can find an assortment that's much better. And I never spent 5 seconds on any one of them. And they all disappeared, along with the obsession to drink. So, I believe this. If we honestly apply the first 9 steps to ourselves for sobriety only, at number 9, when we finish it, we are surrendered. That's the purpose of the first 9 steps of this program. To squeeze us out of ourselves. To get rid of self-thinking. To get rid of the human ego, if you will. And it squeezes it right out of us if we get here not surrendered. We are surrendered if we do that. And then we can look deeper than ourselves and find us, which includes our relationship to each other and to God. And it's a fantastic discovery, and it's an inside job. You see, we have to find him where he is. And I believe that the great cosmic joke is that God hid himself in the last place we ever look, right here. The last place we ever look. So we uncover it and discover it where it is. And that's right here. Now, along with this discovery comes a feeling of dignity, of value, of worth that is unspeakably wonderful. And it has absolutely nothing to do with the human ego, but it has everything to do with gratitude, gratitude, gratitude. So grateful you can't see, because you discover the thing you've been looking for all your life. Now, I haven't much time. I haven't any. But again, it's not my fault. So I want to take just a couple of minutes to see if anybody else thinks like I do. That is, in the past, the teachers and whatnot of the past. I have the feeling that the carpenter man saw things pretty much the way I think I see them. Because he said, I and my father are one. Not two, one. A little later on, he said, I am in the Father, and he and me, and I in you. And that's pretty close, isn't it? It's pretty close. And a little later on, he said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. Hear me? That's what we're talking about. There was a little old guy. He wasn't, didn't mount much. He was just a monk. He was a pot and pan washer in a monastery just outside Paris. He lived in 1666. And we were boys together. Now, his name was Brother Lawrence. And he was a Carmelite. Brother, the reason for the being for the Carmelites is a practice of the presence of God. And that's AA. They thought it was religion. But you see, they found it a little before we did, but they knew we were going to find it, and so they called it religion. So, Brother Lawrence said he was washing his pots and pans, and everybody was yelling something different at the same time. He didn't pay any attention to them. He just went ahead washing pots and pans and talking to God. Said he never knew when his prayers of office started and stopped and his prayers began. And he became quite a successful counselor for people in trouble. He was talking to one of these old boys one day, and he said to him, he is within you. Look not for him elsewhere. That's what we're talking about. And there was another guy. He was Dominican. Lived in Germany about the same time, Brother Lawrence. And he said it like this. You have heard that nature abhors a vacuum. I tell you that God abhors a vacuum, can't abide a vacuum any place under heaven, however small. Now, says he, all you got to do is get empty of self. Or in other words, surrender. And automatically, you're full of God. Automatically. Now, that comes near explaining what happened to me in January 1946 than anything I've ever read. And I'm going to step up. I'm going to talk a little out of sync. If you're Irish, his name was St. Augustine. If you're like me, it was St. Augustine. Now, St. Augustine was a bad boy. He reminded me a great deal of me because he had a very strong weakness for strong drink. And he had a very strong weakness for women. And I identify a little with him. His mama was praying for him for 40 years, and he'd go by her and say, Mama, keep it up. Some of these days it might take. And it did, so help me. And there's a devotee of his in this room tonight that told me that St. Augustine, for 1,000 of the 2,000 years since the birth of Jesus, was the authority in the Catholic Church on Christianity. You know? So that's quite an up jump. It's like Clancy in Alcoholics Anonymous. Really. So, he was talking to God after things got good. He was talking to God. And this is what he said. He said, too late have I loved thee, O thou beauty of ancient days yet ever new. Too late have I loved thee, and behold, thou wert within, and I abroad. That's what I'm talking about. And there I searched for thee, deformed I, plunging amidst the fair forms which thou hast made. Thou wert with me, but I was not with thee. That's terrific. God, that just blows my mind. Because that was my life for 43 years. And this, with this I close. In my last days of drinking, I had a son that was as big as I was. And he wasn't drunk. And so he was the bird dog to keep me in hand. And when I got home and put that car of mine in the garage, I was never allowed to take it out until I'd sobered up. And on occasion, I would run out of medicine after the stores had closed. And I can't have my car. And what am I going to do? So I commandeer one of the boys' bicycles. And I ride all over Beverly Hills trying to talk somebody out of a bottle after hours. And quite often I did. Now, here's the thing I want to say to you. I've got a big window with a beautiful view. And I like to look out that window and see lots of things. And sometimes I can't see out the window because your faces are all over it. It's blocked by your faces. And I sit there and bawl to myself. Nobody around but me. And sometimes I'm sitting there and I see me on that bicycle, hunting, you know, traveling, all over Beverly Hills, hunting for something. And I see God riding right with me. And he's saying to himself, look at this silly son of a bitch. Hunting all over Beverly Hills for me when I'm riding with him all the time. God bless you. Thank you very much.
I'm most grateful and pleased to be here tonight to not only to have an opportunity to participate in this meeting, but to celebrate Halloween with the rest of you. And to maybe in a few moments try and share a little bit of what I used to be like and what happened and what I feel like I'm like now. It seems like that I've been a regular member of this meeting by raising my hand and identifying myself and saying that I'm from Memphis, Tennessee. The last couple of months, it seems I've made more regular meetings here in this home group than I have in my regular home group in Memphis, Tennessee. And but tonight especially, there's some people here that I haven't seen for a long time. And I feel so good and so grateful to see some of these people because of the special meaning for me. I got sober here in Los Angeles almost 14 years ago. And a lot of the people knew me in the beginning of my sobriety and as the days and weeks and years rolled on. And they know what the real Arlie Henderson's like. And what I'm getting at is this. When I moved to Memphis a little over 2 years ago, they're presented with an Arlie Henderson that they never got to see doing the shenanigans that some of you got to see him do. And it's good for me to come back and see some of the people that were able to look right through me and tell me how it really is. Because if I'm not careful, I'll listen to what those people think of Arlie Henderson back in Memphis, Tennessee. And I'm in trouble. Because there's of the newcomers here tonight, there wasn't a dingier person that came on board than yours truly. In a kind of a reverse sort of a way. I had a false front that I was all well put together. And a lot of people didn't think there was much wrong with old Arlie. And I liked those people. And I stuck with them. I was polite and kind and dressed in basic black with a maroon tie once in a while if I wanted to really live it up. I tell you how sick I really was. One time a guy put me down. He thought he was putting me down, but he said, "You know, Arlie, you look like a Polish undertaker." And I took it as a compliment. But it's, again, good for me to come back to L.A. and to walk some of the streets and see some of the people and see some of the places that are very meaningful to me. Earlier this week, I drove down a street that only a few people of you know about, and that's Carmelina Avenue, and that's how I got started with Clancy, the man that's celebrating his 20th birthday tonight. And comparing the backyard when I was there, we might have six people turn up and play a little miniature golf once in a while on a Saturday afternoon. And now I go over to his yard, and he has to yell at people to keep them out of the street. And it's quite a change. I don't blame anything or anyone for my alcoholism. I really don't blame alcohol, just myself, because I know that I was born and raised with the freedom of choice that I could have done anything I wanted to do. But I liked alcohol and everything it did for me, and I used it and abused it. And I'm supposed to know a lot about alcoholism, but I don't. I really don't need to know too much about it. I'm interested in what keeps me sober today. All I can say is that I drank too much, or maybe I should say just the right amount. I think Joe the Wino says that if he'd have drank any more, he'd have died, and if he drank any less, he'd still been drinking, or something like that. And I feel that same way. I drank just the right amount. That whatever it took to get me here was just right. Alcohol was a part of it. Some of the situations that happened in my life thank God they happened. I'm grateful for them. The people that threw me out of the post office and didn't want to mess with me anymore because I couldn't get to work. And the police sergeant in Los Angeles, that helped save my life because I thought I was crazy and totally insane. And in fact, that seemed to be the best thing going for me that Sunday morning, January 31st, 1965, was that the only thing that looked good to me, forever, was a nut house or some place they could put me away and I never have to worry about coming to a decision again. And thank God this psychologist knew what he was dealing with, because he handled me in a most non-psychiatric manner, because he looked me in the eye and he says, "I don't think you're crazy." He says, "I don't think you have that problem." And then with all the love that a bull sergeant on the Los Angeles Police Department can give you, he looked at me in the eye and he said, "Henderson, your problem is that you're nothing but a goddamn drunk." And that hurt my feelings, and I cried. You see, my sense of values at that time, I was willing to be totally, you know, crazy, totally insane, and locked up for forever. But I wasn't willing to be called a drunk. Sick. And they put me out. And I haven't had a drink since. I went to my first AA meeting 3 days later. And I walked in, and again, alcohol or alcoholism or what they were reading out of chapter 5 didn't mean a whole heck of a lot to me. I heard one guy said, you don't ever have to drink again if you don't want to. And that kind of meant something to me. But what I identified with and what happened to me and for me was this. Is someone else said, you don't ever have to hurt again as long as you live if you don't want to. And that's what I grabbed onto, because I didn't want to hurt ever again. And I've been here ever since. And what has been given to me here and what I learned in the basic training of my Alcoholics Anonymous years early on can be used all over this damn world, because he gave me the most important thing for me, a loser, a quitter, a person that runs away from every obligation, is a little dumb word that's in the 12th step. You just try. And that's the difference between what I used to be like and what I think I'm like now. Before, I had to accomplish and always failed. And now all I have to do is try and not plan on the result. And something has happened to me. I'm a different Arlie Henderson. I'm a different Arlie Henderson that walked the streets 14 years ago. And thank God. I can't begin to tell you how much you mean to me and how I feel inside tonight. I feel like it's my birthday and not Clancy. I'm going back to Memphis tomorrow. I'm looking forward to a good, fine weekend. I'm going to have an AA roundup there. We don't have big things there. We'll probably have, if we have half of this auditorium of people attending that roundup, it'll be successful. But again, I want to thank Cy for asking for me to share with you tonight. And I really love you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Arlie. Our second 10-minute speaker is Yvonne N.
My name is Yvonne, and I'm an alcoholic. I agree with Arlie. There's more folks here tonight than go to our state conference in Oklahoma, you know. That's where I'm from. I came out here for the celebration. We aren't really known for anything, I don't guess, except our football team. And we say we have the best one that money can buy, you know. But it is a privilege, really, to talk with you all this evening for a few minutes and share. I'm suffering from the disease of alcoholism, which is irreversible, irrevocable, permanent, and potentially fatal. I don't know why I have the disease of alcoholism, and, you know, you hear a lot of talk about environment and about heredity. And I have three practicing uncles that are alcoholic now, practicing alcoholic aunt, an alcoholic grandfather, an alcoholic great uncle, an alcoholic mother, and I'm Irish and Indian and come from the Bible Belt. And that's enough, right there. And I think with a composite of all these things, I really didn't have a chance. I don't know why I started drinking, except when I was a teenager, I looked around me, and all I ever wanted to do was just to feel normal, because I never did. And I tried to feel on the inside like I thought that everybody else looked on the outside. I was raised in an alcoholic home, And I went through all of the things that alcoholic children must endure. And we had at our house, every weekend, we had the Saturday night divorce. With the packing of the suitcases and the leaving and the fighting. And I said, when I grow up, I'll never be that way. And I don't know why my mother drinks like she does. But I know this. If alcohol did to me, or it will do to me, the same thing that it does to her, I'll never, ever live like this again. And then when I was 16 years old, I found out when I took my first drink what alcohol really did. And for the first time in my life, I felt normal and drank socially. And then I think as my disease progressed, I began to drink for basically one reason. And that is that I could not stand the world as it was, and I couldn't change it, and it was intolerable for me to live in it. And so consequently, I tried through chemicals of any kind that I could get, and through booze, I made an effort to change my environment. I drank because I always had great ambitions and hopes and daydreams, you know, of what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I had this image way out there of what it was going to be like and the kind of person that I was going to be, how successful, and I could achieve anything. And I drank because now I understand that I had a void inside me. I didn't know that then. And the chemicals filled that void. I drank to relieve the pain, the god-awful pain that I could not endure. And then I drank because I wanted to be free. And I didn't understand until I came to AA that a person could be free, could experience freedom, and at the same time be responsible. And I always thought if you had freedom, you didn't have any responsibility at all. You know? And I guess I kind of wanted to be like Peter Pan and just never grow up and live in Never Never Land, because I came to AA with the emotions of a child and the body of a 38-year-old woman. And it was a difficult task for me to attempt to grow up emotionally, and I'm still trying. I think I have a long ways to go. But I had three children, and when I drank to fulfill that image of the thing that I always wanted to be, of what I wanted to be like, I suddenly found out that when I drank, I was being the thing that I didn't want to be. And I was kind of reliving in my own mind the experiences that I had suffered when I was growing up. And I wasn't a good wife, and I wasn't a good mother. And I was a complete and total failure at everything that I'd tried. And so consequently, I think when I crossed over the line and was ready to make my first surrender, which was many years later, that I no longer drank to fulfill that image, because the image was of the thing that I didn't want to be. It didn't do me any good because I couldn't get rid of the void inside me. I couldn't get rid of the pain, because the more I drank, it created problems, and I drank to forget them. And lastly, I was not free at all. But I think I was a slave to the bottle, and I was just fettered with all chemicals. Now, I didn't have a power of choice anymore. And so I came to AA, making my first surrender. Alcohol had always been my friend. It had taken me where I wanted to go. It had made me become the thing that I wanted to be. And psychologically, the feeling that I had was not that I was going to give up a friend, because I could never feel deprived of anything. And it wasn't the giving up of a friend, but the getting rid of an enemy. And it was with this attitude that I took my first step. And if I had done what I was supposed to have done, I would have been sober 19 and a half years tonight, but I'm a slow learner. And I went to my first AA meeting in 1959. And all of my life, and today, the living problems that I have, many of them are based upon comparison. Because I compared my way right out of AA in 1959. I had graduated from law school. I had a good job. And I hadn't done the things that other alcoholics had done. I had no family to lose. And so when I went to that AA meeting and I listened to what those people talked about, their tales of woe, I said, that hasn't happened to me. And besides that, I know so much about AA because my mother had gone into AA and I had learned all about the steps and the traditions, and I knew what alcoholics did. I knew about the morning drink. And I had insurance, you see, with knowledge, self-knowledge, not to ever become an alcoholic. And so with this comparison, I walked back out and for 10 years lived in hell. And then in 1969, when I came into AA, the comparison was still going on. But at this point in time, I was willing to listen to people who apparently had a handle on living. It was something that I hadn't mastered yet. And I was told that my alcoholism was like an automobile accident, that it was not the fuel that was at fault, but it was the driver. In the big book, it says our problems are of our own making, and the bottle is but a symptom of the things that are wrong with us. We have to stop fighting everything and everybody. Well, that's the most difficult thing. And today, my problems are again in comparison. When I go through self-pity fits, I am comparing my plot in life with yours, and I'm feeling sorry for myself, and it's the feeling of deprivation. When I have my stages of being a perfectionist, again, I'm comparing my standards with your standards. And when I get into real trouble in living problems, it's because of this comparison that still goes on in my mind. And I've learned about ego. I have learned that that's the only thing that hurts or gets hurt in a human relationship. I have learned that it is the only thing that stands between me and my higher power. I want to close and just tell you a kind of a parable. I just got back from Canada about 6 weeks ago, and they tell the story up there about the two groups of people, and they were impaired physically, and they had arms about this long, and one group were normies and the other group were alcoholics and drunks, and both groups were starving to death, and they had two huge banquet rooms. And so they took all the normal people and they told them to go into the banquet room and to eat all they wanted to eat, satisfy their hunger. But there was one condition, and that condition was that they had to promise to eat with the utensils that were provided. And the forks were this long. And so they stood outside the banquet rooms and they heard the screaming and the squealing and the commotion and the gluttony and the selfishness and the lack of satisfaction. And they went in and people were stabbing the meat with forks and there was complete chaos. And then they went into the next banquet room and there they found the alcoholics and there wasn't a sound. And when they went in, the alcoholics were being satisfied from their hunger because they saw the alcoholics feeding each other. And that's what AA is all about. Thank you.
Happy birthday, Jane. Our next birthday is for 7 years, for Tom H.
My name's Tom Hoy, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank Clint, who sponsored and helped me early in my program. And I want to thank Clancy, who's been my sponsor for the last few years. And I want to thank all the people in this room that have been a part of my life and have touched my sobriety and helped it along. This is a belated cake. The night of my sobriety, I was boarding a plane to go to the Middle East, and I called my sponsor, thanking him, and I asked him last week if it would be all right if I took a cake here, because this is my home group. By circumstances, I'm living in Florida now, which I couldn't prevent, and as far as I'm concerned, I will be back here. It's very important to me to remember this room and the people here, because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had earned my way into it. with all the humiliation and all the anger and frustrations and people I had hurt and the jails I'd gone to and many, many things that we as alcoholics do. And I knew the day that I came that there, I had to find something, because the day I came in and at, and I sat in the first few meetings, I couldn't remember what was being said, but I had a notebook that I still have that I used to sit and write the things down that I heard in the meetings. And I remember I'd be walking down the street or sitting in, and I'd be pushing cobwebs out of my face that weren't there. And that's why it's important. Last year I missed taking a cake here, and I felt it. So I made the determination that this year I wanted to take it. And I was told during a coffee break that I'd given up that right because I moved to another area. Well, I didn't give up that right. I'm Tom Hoy, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a member of the Pacific Group. Thank you very much.